joining me now is someone who leads an incredibly glamorous life. She's a teacher, but she's also an activist and a fashionista. She has, among other things, graced the cover of Vogue magazine. Sinead Burke, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. This is such a treat. Thank you.
Well, it's a treat for me to have you. And, you know, it was a treat for me as well to look at your Instagram page. I suppose a lot of pictures there from another time where you're wearing these amazing clothes. You're hanging out with Victoria Beckham, Kate Blanchett, Will and Kate at the Met Gala and everything. I presume this pandemic has put a stop to your gala for a while, has it?
It has, but I'm still meeting glamorous people
you're
like yourself,
Brandon. You're still fabulous, aren't you? Yes, good, good. The one thing I notice is that, like, it must be a fashionista's dream living your life. You get to wear these extraordinary clothes, Prada, Gucci, Givenchy, Louis Vuitton, Ferragamo, high heels and everything. And for people who don't know you, because you are a little person, they are all custom made by the designers for you.
They are. And in many ways, it kind of proves the argument that I've been trying to make probably since I was a teenager, that being able to design for either disabled people or bodies that are often not considered within a fashion lens is possible. There just needs to be momentum behind it. There needs to be different types of conversations happening in the industry to allow for this. And the work that I try to do in fashion is using the influence of the luxury fashion industry to begin thinking about designing for disabled people as a way in which to design for everybody. So these clothes that I'm wearing a dress that has a chiffon cream sleeve. It is full length with plissé and pleats, and it has lots of cheese because it's designed by a brand called Gucci. But what they have done for me is possible for everyone. I want to see thinking about the removal of zips from clothes because they're tricky for everyone, but particularly for disabled people. I want to see greater sensitivity of fabric, particularly for autistic people, but for anybody. And then customization, like alterations, which are best for me because I need things that are shorter sleeved and shorter length in terms of trousers. But that has value even for somebody like you. Maybe you prefer wearing 3/4 length sleeves. And I think what I'm trying to do in the fashion industry is use the aesthetic of beautiful clothes to prove the point that designing for everyone is possible and it should be happening right now.
Yeah, and that you will, well, I think what you need to teach those people is you will make money from this as well, because that's ultimately what they'll care about too, isn't it? Now, it probably comes from your own life and your own experience in that, and you've written about this in your new book, that buying clothes for you when you were a kid and when you were younger and when you were growing up was a very upsetting thing.
It was a real challenge. You know, I am a disabled woman, but I'm also the eldest of five children. I have three sisters and one brother, and they are non-disabled. And I think as the eldest of all of them, when I was a teenager, I thought it was kind of my job to show them the way through fashion. I remember bringing my sisters shopping and I was like, oh, I know this, I'll show you. And very quickly, it became obvious that they had more access than I did, both in terms of the clothes that they could buy, but also the notion that they could physically pick something up off a rail without help or go to the cash register or go to the changing rooms. And I think if children understand anything, it's this notion of injustice. I just thought it was unfair. Mm. And I understood the power of clothes to narrate to the world who I am. Like, I'm sitting across from you and you're looking at what I'm wearing and you will have assumptions about who I am because of that. Please don't tell me what they are, but you will. And it gives me a tool to challenge the biases that people might have based on my disability, that I think is really powerful.
So when your sisters, you had how many?
I have three sisters.
Three. And you're the only one in the family who is a little person.
My father's a little person also. So I inherited my dwarfism from my father. But 80% of little people are born to two average height parents. So in a sense, many people listening to this interview can be in a position where they could have a child who has dwarfism or a relative or even a friend.
Did you know many other little people when you were growing up in that?
For me, it was always such an incredible benchmark to have my dad. When people would ask me, why are you so small? From 4 onwards, I would say I'm just like my dad. But my parents are extraordinary people. You know, they told me that I could do anything that I wanted to do from my first day in school. And that was fundamental to the person that I became. But when I was 7, my parents founded Little People of Ireland, which is an organization voluntary run for little people and their families. And every year when we're not in a pandemic, we have an annual conference where we bring together hundreds of people to share education, information and social activities. And growing up with this growing community of people who looked like me was so fundamental to my personality, whether it was asking the other girls who were my age group, where did they get their shoes? Or how can we think about the Debs? Or talking to people saying, yeah, are people cruel to you in public? How can we manage that? Or answering parents' questions who, you know, their baby has just been born and the baby's diagnosed with dwarfism and they have nervousness and anxieties and fears, and trying to calm those questions has been just the spinal cord of who I am.
You mentioned that first day at school when you were four, and you had extraordinary kind of, I don't know, was it poise?
Or,
yeah, to tell the listeners what you said when you arrived into school, a four-year-old.
So I arrived into school on the day of my fourth birthday, and my birthday's in the middle of September. I think in some ways it was trying to make sure that if I needed to repeat a year in school, that I'd age on my side. So I started a little bit later than everybody else, which meant, of course, in my four-year-old head, I had to prepare a monologue and a speech. So I walked into the classroom on the first day. The teacher said, this is Sinead. She's joining our class. Sinead, do you want to say hello? And I began by saying, hi, my name is Sinead. I have achondroplasia. That's achondroplasia. And I'm going to be a teacher. Thankfully, the other girls in my class, I went to an all-girls school, just said hi. And I was welcomed into that class community. And I think that taught me the power of education, that it can be a catalyst for thinking about inclusion, not just within children and younger people, but the world as a whole. And I loved going to the classroom library. And I think in many ways, you know, having just written a book, it stemmed from those moments of going to that library, picking up books, never seeing somebody who looked like me on the cover or in the stories. And then when I was a teacher, knowing the value of being able to teach different types of stories about different types of experiences, mm-hmm. that in the quieter parts of this year, when I had a little bit of time, I kind of had notions about myself and was like, oh, maybe I'll write a book. And now it's out in the world.
And it's a great book. We'll come on to it in a minute. Mm. It's interesting. So what you say about the girls in your class, I look back on when I was a kid in school and I look at how I think kids are now, and I think there's been a huge change in that generation or two, as to like when I remember back how we were about difference and stuff, it wasn't something we understood and it wasn't something we really taught how to deal with. And I see kids now and I think they're much more open and just accepting and everything. You did have some difficulty in school, did you?
I did. And I think you raised such an important point, you know, that in the past we weren't taught about difference. I think in some ways there's still an element of that that's true to society. We don't really have a curriculum of equity or a curriculum of inclusion. There are still so much parts of the differences of people in their identities that we don't expose. We think those things are too adult to talk to children about. But in many ways, we need to reflect children's curiosity. On my first day of teaching, you know, a child would ask me, why are you so small?
Yeah.
And I'd say, well, why are you so big? And the child would think about it and go, I don't know, I was born like this. And I'd say, well, so was I.
Yeah.
And they're like, great, what page are we on? And I'm like, page 4, if you could colour that in, good man yourself, that'd be great. And I think in many ways, that's the response that we want to be cultivating in children. But yeah.
And you wouldn't criticise that child for actually asking the question, for saying what's on his mind.
Absolutely not. Yeah. We need to encourage that. And that's not to say that everybody who is different needs to be in the role of a public teacher educating
and
the masses.
Explaining themselves all
that's
the time.
Not,
yeah.
It shouldn't be your job to exist that you need to educate the world. But within a classroom environment, as the teacher, that's a role that I'm so comfortable in and embrace and welcome. But yeah, as you were saying, I mean, it's easy to look at photographs on Instagram and think, oh, great, she has a wonderful wardrobe. It must be so much better now. And in some ways it is. But I'll still have experiences walking down the street where people will point, stare, call me terrible names, take photographs and videos without my consent and just make
people
me feel
will
less.
Take a picture of you while they're walking past.
Oh, yeah, that's the, in terms of the scale of things like that happen, that's at the very bottom. Yeah, I've had instances where, you know, in Dublin last year, I was just walking down the street and two teenage boys walked past me and I thought nothing of it until 30 seconds later, one of them leapfrogged over me from behind, as in leaped from the ground over my head to the other side of me, all the while his friend recorded it on his phone. I imagine to put it on Instagram or TikTok because they understood that it would go viral. And I was so upset for so many reasons. Number one, because how did they come up with that idea so quickly? And number two, like, they didn't even think of me as a person in the sense that, like, what if they'd have missed? What if they'd have kicked me in the head? There was no time to consider the actual impact of it. And I think in many ways, the reason why they didn't think of that, they didn't see me as a person. They just saw me as an object by which virality on the internet could exist. And in many ways, you know, my immediate reaction was to ring my mother, age 29, going, "Mom." And I was, I'm being glib, but I was really upset. And my second response...
So you don't get hardened to this kind of thing at all. Like, just for people to know,
yeah,
those things really upset you every time they happen, yeah?
Actually, I had an instance 2 weeks ago where I was trying to walk to the supermarket to buy a packet of biscuits at 5 o'clock in the evening when it was still bright. There was a group of young people outside and one person saw me first and ran over and said, "Look at what's behind me, look at it." And I thought, what? Who's an it? And I know that if I met those people on an individual basis, they wouldn't say anything. But how do we change that collective need to make ourselves appear cool or funny to our friends? And since when is the currency of coolness being able to make somebody else feel unsafe? You know, all I'm trying to do with my work in education and advocacy, and even in this book, is encourage us to design a world in the future where people get to be safe to exist just as they are.
So you feel unsafe a lot of the time?
Oh, totally. I think I'm not the only person. I think so many people leave their home thinking about having to be observant around them, who is looking at them, who could cause harm, who could make them feel unsafe. I think it's so much a part of my modus operandi and who I am now that I don't even acknowledge it. I think I have been in a couple of spaces in my life where I have felt safety, and it's been remarkable being able to walk down the street and nobody looking, staring, pointing.
I think, did you mention it in the book or did you mention it in somewhere I read, how finding clubbing and
yeah,
realizing, oh, this is what clubbing is. Just explain that,
yeah,
to people.
I think, like most people who train to be teachers, I've experienced specific nightclubs in Dublin. And I remember my first time going, and when people were inebriated and had substances in their system, their understanding of what they should and shouldn't do was vague, shall we say. And people would stand in front of me. I'd had experiences where people lifted me up without my consent, and it made me not want to be in those spaces. And it frustrated me so much, because why did somebody else's actions make me want to change who I was? But in many ways, my experience of nightlife was transformed when I was exposed to the queer community and the LGBTQ community, and being able to dance in a space that was the George in Dublin, where everybody had this visceral understanding of what it was like to be different, yeah, what it was like to be observed, and gave everybody permission to be free. And I have never enjoyed dancing to Madonna's Vogue more,
yeah,
than in that moment when I was 20 and 21. But I think, yeah, it's education.
You said, you know, this, this is why people enjoy it.
And I was like, oh my gosh, this is why you go out on a Saturday night. I, yeah, get it. But going back to that instance of those two boys in the middle of the street, you know, for me, with a background in education, I'm always trying to come up with a solution that if I rang the police and reported that instance, all that they would learn in that moment is not to get caught, not why it was wrong. So I went to every school in the vicinity of the area in which that happened, primary and secondary, and shared parts of my experience to try to cultivate empathy, to try to make them realise that I wasn't an object but a person, and to try to build connections. You know, one of the things that I said to those groups was, I think I'm really lucky. What makes me different is immediately obvious. But how many of you have your difference that's invisible? And how long are we friends before you have to tell me what that is, whether that's dyslexia, whether that's poverty at home, whether that's homelessness, whether that's coming out? And just trying to underline the notion that we are all different, and the erasure of that has never been more vital to be talking about it so openly.
And you see, you've taken on a big job, really, which is that, and this, I suppose it's at the core of the book. The book is called Break the Mold, How to Take Your Place in the World, I should say. But the core of this, Sinead, is, and I think it's a decision that a lot of people with disabilities and their advocates and everything come to at a certain point, which is, I'm not changing. So basically, I need to change the world, which is a much bigger job. But basically, my disability is actually not about me. It's about how the world is set up, yeah?
Brendan, if you had to live in a world that was designed for me, you'd be disabled. You'd have backache. Mm. You'd probably have migraines. I'm not disabled because of my dwarfism, but because furniture, society and culture was designed without including people who look like me. And I think the solution that we're trying to take as we look at, I don't know if it's genetics, eugenics, all of these things, our solution is to fix people in order to fit in.
You did think of fixing yourself at one point, didn't you, when you were 11?
In many ways, Brendan, but particularly when I was 11. Yeah, I was offered surgery when I was 11, called limb lengthening surgery, which would have meant the deliberate fracturing of my leg bones. And over the course of several months, they would be stretched apart for new bone and marrow to grow. I spent a lot of time thinking about it. My parents, being very brave, said, "This is your decision to make. We can't make it for you." I think as they began to step away from being an advocate for me and allowing me to be an advocate for myself, and I began to contemplate who I would be taking the surgery for. And I realized after much kind of thought that I would be doing it to make friends easier, because maybe people would be less awkward if I skewed slightly closer to what everyone else appeared like. And at 11, I made the decision that if people didn't like me, primarily because I was a little person, that wasn't my issue. That was theirs. And they've just told me really early on that they're not the kind of people that I want to associate with. And I just decided that I was really comfortable and happy being me. And yeah, furniture and public bathrooms and not being able to reach things is a challenge. But those are the things that can be changed. Not me.
That's a big philosophical question for an 11-year-old to have to tackle, isn't it? Like, do I essentially erase my identity in a way in order to kind of make life easier for other people in a way?
I don't know if I had that kind of enormous understanding of the decision that I was making, but I think I just sat with a list and it was like, okay, great, I'll be able to reach light switches, but I'm choosing to suit everybody else rather than me. And I think making that decision for myself was so fundamental to who I became that I just had this confidence that I was good enough just as I was.
To give people an example, okay, mm-hmm. and this is not me being nosy, but
please be nosy.
You write about it in the book. Just to give people an example of the granular detail of how difficult everything can be if the world isn't designed for you. You mentioned using a public toilet.
Absolutely.
Talk us through the difficulties of that.
Sure. So if you can visualise yourself coming to a bathroom, particularly in a public space, if you're going into the cubicle, the first obstacle is the lock on the door. Usually it is at a very high height. So I do a couple of things. I usually try to see if there is a bin. If there is, I bring it into the cubicle, turn it upside down, stand on it, hope it takes my weight and close it. If that doesn't work, I use my phone. I have a very large phone in order to twack it across. If that doesn't work, I take off my coat and my bag and I place it on the floor of the cubicle in the hope that somebody coming past will see that it's occupied and not come in. And if that doesn't work, I go and approach a stranger in the bathroom, which is not ideal in a pandemic, and say, "Would you mind standing outside? I really need to use the bathroom." And after I use the bathroom, I come out. And then I can't wash my hands because I cannot reach the sink and the soap dispenser. And what's intriguing for me is that, you know, we live in a world where there are children, lots of them. And many parents listening to this will be all too familiar with having to pick their child up and haul them up over a sink in order to wash their hands. So whatever about not designing the world for me, a little person, where there may not be too many statistics by which you can say, okay, it makes sense. There are lots of children in this world. Why are we not including them when we think about design? And for me, something like the public bathroom, whether it is for a disabled person, whether it is for a member of the trans community, what we are saying when we don't design places like bathrooms for everyone is we are putting a time limit by which you can be in a public space. We are saying you are not welcome here, or you are welcome here until your bladder says that you must leave. And what kind of world do we want to live in? Whilst the design of bathrooms may not have been deliberately done to exclude people like me, by the lack of inclusion, we are just inviting only a specific cohort to exist.
Now, listen, I've used up most of our time and we talked about all the difficulties of the situation. We didn't talk about your extraordinary journey then from teacher to activist, and now how do you describe what you do now, or what's your, it's kind of a portfolio career in a way, isn't it?
That's a very kind description. I might use that as a new Twitter bio. Thank you. I have just set up a company called Tilting the Lens, and what I would like to do is bring in this notion of education, design, and try to think about accessibility through a lens of creativity and innovation, because progress is not just progress for me. It is great that I get to sit across from you in a beautiful dress, but how do we actually make change that is systemic, that is for people right now and the next generation? And it has to be about more than just the exception. It has to become the rule. And that's what I want to do by leveraging this company. And hopefully something like Break the Mold is a really good place to start, because if we can encourage the next generation and CEOs at the same time, change will happen just a little bit quicker.
You're not half ambitious, are you?
No.
So the book then is kind of, it's encouraging. Is it for kids who are different, or is it really for all kind of kids, encouraging them to kind of dream big like that?
It's a toolkit for all children, parents, and I think some adults too. You know, there is conversations around accessibility and identity politics within the book, which are very broad topics that sometimes even adults find difficult to grapple with. They don't know where to start.
I'm a privileged white male, and I actually learned a lot out of the book.
Thank
you.
So it's to try to create a blueprint for us to encourage anybody who reads this book to realize not just that they are enough as they are, but already within them, they have the tools to make a difference. Whether that's in small conversations in the playground where a friend of yours calls somebody else gay, what do you say, age 9? Well, maybe you say, maybe he is gay. It's okay to be gay, but it's not okay to be cruel and unkind. Or maybe it's trying to be an ally in a broader sense, or maybe it's just trying to figure out the monologue that you need in your head to remind you every day that, yeah, you don't look like your friend, or you don't look like the models in the magazine, but you don't have to, because you can be you. And I hope that it, yeah, makes at least one child feel more comfortable in their own skin.
Do you still have that monologue in your own head? Do you still have to remind yourself, like, who you are and that you're enough and everything?
Yeah, I won't tell you what the monologue was saying to me as I was sitting outside about to come in for this interview. And I just had to, I suppose, recondition it, right? We're so conditioned by the world that it was like, it's going to be fine. You and Brendan have a common goal, a common interest on these topics. And what's the worst that can happen? Well, you could embarrass yourself on national radio, which wouldn't be so great. But I think we all have these moments where we need to remind ourselves that we're okay. We're doing okay. We could be better. We could be worse, but we're doing okay.
Listen, it's been an absolute pleasure. Good luck with changing the world. I will check back in a year and see. And
oh, you're
see
on the journey now, Brendan.
Yeah. Okay, listen, thanks a million, Sinead Burke. And the book is called Break the Mold, How to Take Your Place in the World. And it's illustrated as well beautifully by Natalie Byrne, we should say. And it's published by Wren and Rook. Is that right? And it's in the shops now. Sinead, thank you so much.
Thank you.
An absolute pleasure.
Email brendan@rte.ie.